Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. Here we are in America, the split screen pictures of protests, the urban centers burning, and yet the stock market seems to be shrugging this off, mainly because I guess they've decided that the coronavirus is so last week, we don't need to worry about that, and somehow all of this urban unrest is going to go away. Who knows? We are joined on the podcast again by Sarah Longwell. Sarah, thanks for coming back on. Appreciate it very much.
Thanks for having me, Charlie.
So let's talk about the Republican. This seems like an old story, except well, we play the hits here. The Republican profiles in Courage. I'm sure you saw this. Casey Hunt from NBC committed a flagrant act of journalism by standing with a microphone and asking one Republican senator after another to comment on the president's action where they used force to disperse a completely peaceful protest in order to give himself a photo op at this church. The photo op, of course, he didn't go into the church. He didn't pray in the church. We'll talk about that a little bit later. But so Casey Hunt is asking the Republican senators whether they thought the president did the right thing. And of course, here's what she got.
Senator McConnell, was what the president did last night the right thing to do? Senator, nice to see you. Was what the president did last night right? Senator, was what the president did last night with the peaceful protesters outside the White House the right thing to do?
Pardon?
What the president did, the peaceful protesters that were dispersed with tear gas, he then walked across the street to the church. Was that the right thing to do?
Didn't really see it.
Senator, is what the president did yesterday at St. John's, was that appropriate? Was it an abuse of power? Senator Roberts? Was what the president did last night at St. John's, was that appropriate? Was clearing the protesters an abuse of power? I'm sorry?
I don't have any comment.
You don't have any comment on what happened at the White House last night?
The what?
The gassing of White House protesters, do they have a right?
I didn't watch that.
Senator Enzi, are you concerned at all about what happened at the White House last night?
Sorry, I'm late for lunch.
Senator Blackburn, do you have any concerns about what unfolded at the White House last night? Senator Portman, do you think what we saw last night at the White House...
I'm late for lunch.
Senator Cassidy, was what we saw at the White House last night an abuse of power?
I didn't follow up.
And my favorite was, of course, when she asked Ted Cruz, was there an abuse of power? Yes, by the protesters. So, Sarah, I guess I need somebody to redefine what a constitutional conservative is, asking for a friend here.
Yeah, we've needed that for a minute. I think that's might be what you call a parade of cowards. The best was like a bunch of people being like, the president, I don't even know him. What protests? It was crazy to watch it go on and have each of them realize she was asking them a tough question, and then to just blatantly ignore it. And it's sort of like when Mitch McConnell was asked and he said, you know, well, I'm not going to critique somebody else's performance. But of course, what was it, a week ago when Barack Obama dared to say just a little something, he was talked about how horrible that was. So, you know, they've got an opinion. They just don't want to share it.
Well, it is interesting. I hate to tag him because he's not part of this, but it was kind of the Paul Ryan thing when they would ask him about the president's tweets. When he got tired of actually answering the question, that his go-to was, I haven't seen it, didn't read it, didn't hear about it, had no idea. No, television, what is that? I don't know. Okay, so there was at least a little glimmer of hope, and I know we're kind of grasping here. You know, you and I have spent the last 3 years looking for that pony inside the pile of you-know-what in the driveway. Ben Sasse issued a statement that was relatively strong. He said that the president had used the Bible as a prop. There's no right to riot, he said, but there is a constitutional right to protest, and he thinks it's wrong. So, okay, is this the new Ben Sasse safely renominated 2.5 years? What?
Yeah, safely through his primary challenge. 2.5. I don't know. So Ben Sasse has long been my favorite. And I think that, you know, when you genuinely think that a senator is good, right? So there's a lot of politicians you don't think are particularly good, but Ben Sasse has been a standout. And early on in Trump's tenure, he was quite vocal and critical. He was somebody that I think a lot of us were looking to. And then at some point, he vanished. And I am glad he's reemerging, but this is now what we saw him vote in favor of that National Emergency Act. I mean, he's done a lot of things in the last 2 years that unfortunately I think have done a lot to damage his reputation as a clear-eyed constitutional conservative who sort of eschews the tribal and party politics. And it's tough, you know, because one of the reasons we all liked him so much, he's wrote all these books. He seemed like somebody who was kind of an intellectual. And to have had his voice completely silent in the last couple of years when it really, really mattered, and to even have him go the wrong way on a number of things. I'm always glad when they're back and they speak up. I don't want to knock them for that, but it isn't. It's never going to be too little too late, but I'm not gonna overly celebrate Ben Sasse at this point.
No huzzas. Also, it did kind of feel like one step forward, one step back, because Mitt Romney, of all people, went invisible on this as well, had nothing to say about it. So, George W. Bush did something that was extremely unusual. He and his wife issued a statement about the protests, and a lot of people's eyes are, you know, going, okay, you know, George W. Bush weighing in on all of this. So, is W. going to endorse Biden? I mean, I saw this on Twitter last night. Is this a speculation? And if he did, would it make any difference?
I'm not sure that it would make any difference. I mean, it's been shocking to see in the case of Mitt Romney, John McCain, George W. Bush, the predecessors that represented the Republican Party that I think you and I were up for being affiliated with, no longer seem to have much purchase within the Trump Republican Party. In fact, they're sort of actively repudiated the last three standard bearers for the party. That being said, I have been thrilled to see George W. Bush sticking his head out.
Up until this point, I had sort of supported this norm of past presidents should not speak out, especially you know, to point out flaws in the current president. But I think that this moment is so fraught. I think we are on the precipice of something very bad. And I think to have President Bush weighing in is actually a much needed voice at the moment, especially because the way that he's weighing in is just with a lot of heart and a lot of calm. And I think the country needs an addition of those voices right now.
No, I agree with you. So, but on this question of this probably just fanciful speculation about W endorsing Biden, would it make a difference on the edges, other than, of course, causing some folks on the left to lose their minds?
I think it would make a difference. And I think that, look, I would be shocked if he did it. But I guess I wouldn't be as shocked as I would have been in even 2016. You know, if things continue to go down this road, it wouldn't be crazy to have a number of Republican governors who endorse Biden. I could see somebody like Larry Hogan or Charlie Baker endorsing Biden.
Really?
Yeah, I think that, look, I think we have been wondering for a long time, people in our position, if there's something that was going to break the spell, something that would change the trajectory of total and complete accommodation from the Republican Party. And if the last 3 months aren't it, then nothing is. But it is possible in this moment that you could see more elite level Republicans. You know, I still hold out hope that one of these days James Mattis is going to say, hey, I was in there. It wasn't okay. Everything that I saw was alarming. And going into this election, I'm going to tell the American people what I saw and why this guy shouldn't be reelected.
Oh, speaking of Mattis, while we're talking here, Mike Esper, his successor as Secretary of Defense, said this morning that he would not support using active military troops in American cities. So in the last 24 hours, he's really distanced himself from Trump. And when he first said he had no idea that force would be used to against the protesters, that he really didn't know where he was going. He thought he was going to just be reviewing the troops. So there's a little bit of distance there. No, somebody like Mattis, I think, would have might have an impact. The impact of a Bush endorsement would be only on the margins. But this election may be on the margins. And I think this is something that you've talked about and worked on quite a bit. I do think that there is a permission structure that many centrist Republicans need, which is to look around and realize there are other Republicans they've supported in the past that they respect who are giving them permission to do something that would have been unthinkable just a little while ago. And people need to understand how unthinkable it is for a lot of Republicans to vote for Joe Biden any more than our progressive Democrat listeners. You know, what would it take for you to vote for, I don't know, Ted Cruz or Marco Rubio? So, you know, somebody like a W sort of gives a signal that this is an acceptable moment, that we're not dealing with normal party politics.
Yeah, and I think it just comes down to, like, all Republican voters aren't made alike. There are a strong percentage, obviously, who are all in on Donald Trump. But the people who go to a Trump rally are very different from sort of the maybe the right-leaning independents or George W. Bush, John McCain, Mitt Romney voters in the suburbs. They're just not all coming from the same place. And their level of enthusiasm for Donald Trump really ranges from a hold your nose kind of disgust to an all in enthusiasm. And when you start to get to the hold your nose in disgust people who voted for Trump, in a lot of ways, because as they would tell it, they simply didn't vote for him. They had to vote against Hillary Clinton. For those people, Joe Biden doesn't have the same reflexive, antipathy. It doesn't just sort of bring up the same emotions that Hillary Clinton did. And so a lot of those people are absolutely gettable in this moment. And I think that a voice like George W. Bush, especially if what he was explaining is why he felt like it was necessary to do this and the unique danger that Donald Trump represented, and that, you know, Joe Biden was a good man that he had worked with, like that kind of thing could make a difference.
So let's talk about what happened last night, because this was rather significant. Steve King, the resident congressional bigot, was defeated in a primary, unmourned by the GOP establishment. It is just your thoughts on the defenestration of Steve King after all these years.
Well, it couldn't have happened to a worse person. I'm thrilled to see him lose after all this time. But it is interesting to see so many Republicans, and granted, I have sort of a selected group of conservatives and Republicans that I follow on Twitter, but everybody is celebrating Steve King losing. And of course, he lost in a Republican primary, so he lost to another Republican. Many of them acknowledged that he is a racist. He had oftentimes defended white supremacy. This guy was just really the worst. But, you know, Donald Trump, I don't know about you, Charlie. I when I was in my younger days as a young conservative and Republican, I really did defend against the accusation that Republicans were racist.
Oh, yeah.
I thought that was a spurious charge. Mm-hmm. I do not believe that George W. Bush was racist or Mitt Romney. And I think that those guys were done dirty a lot of times and the things that they were accused of. Donald Trump is a racist. Donald Trump is a guy who launched his political career saying that Barack Obama was a Kenyan Muslim and demanding to see his birth certificate, and has told, you know, congresswomen of color, many of whom I disagree with vociferously on policy, that they should go back to where they came from. He talks about Mexican judges and, he wasn't talking about a ban on certain Middle East countries as the policy ultimately wound up. He talked about a Muslim ban. So, I mean, this is, if we can reject Steve King's racism, at some point people have to look at Donald Trump and say, we should reject this guy for a similar reason, among many others.
Well, see, that's the point. And I agree with you. I mean, for years and years and years, I kind of rolled my eyes because every Republican was accused of being a racist. And I think there was a lot of crying wolf that went on here. But there was a kernel there. I mean, there was that latent gene of the Steve Kings of the world that were, in fact, tolerated. And I think one of the questions, you know, everybody's, you know, spiking the football about Steve King being defeated. And I think it's a good thing. But really, I do think Republicans need to ask themselves why he was allowed to be a kingmaker in the party for so long. Do you remember when he used to hold those events in Iowa? And every presidential candidate trooped into Iowa to kiss Steve King's ring. And,
yeah.
You know, I mean, this guy was not just a random political figure. He was very, very influential. And unless you want to believe that he underwent this tremendous conversion to racism, he was the guy all along. And yet nobody objected.
And I think, you know, it took it was only maybe 6 or 8 months ago that he was finally stripped of some of his committee positions. I mean, he held you know, real positions within the party up until not too long ago. And so, you know, I'd like to think that this represents a real moment for the party to, I think, actually potentially look at Donald Trump and say, we have wrought this through too much tolerance of this type of behavior, and that Steve King is I don't want to say a sop, but it is a harbinger of a party that does want to exercise these things, or at least some portion that does. And you know, King held that seat for a long time. Those people knew him there, and so to see him rejected by the people who've elected him for so long is great.
No, it's a positive step forward. There are so many positive steps forward. Okay, so I want to get to your piece that you wrote this week, which was, I think, probably our most viral piece on the Bulwark, which is what did Trump supporters think was going to happen? Is that the headline? Do I have that right? What did they think was going to happen?
Yeah, what did they think was going to happen?
Yeah, really. I mean, you're just totally amazed, right? It's and you can sort of see how they're reacting to all of this. But you know, and I keep coming back to from the very beginning, the one thing I've had the hardest time coping with is watching evangelical Christians look at Donald Trump and saying, yes, he's our guy. And I know this is kind of old and stale, but this week, again, we had the president, you know, doing his performative Christianity where he does that photo op, goes over to the church, does not go into the church, does not pray in the church, does not offer any words of solace. Just holds up the Bible in this awkward, weird manner, doesn't open the Bible, doesn't read the Bible, just uses it as a prop. And it was just so transparent. Now, I have to admit, I'm cheating here a little bit because I saw this on Sarah Cooper's Twitter feed. You know Sarah Cooper, who does this? She's a comedian
I love her.
She's fantastic. She basically lip syncs Trump, but doesn't change Trump's comments. It is Trump with her little bit of a gloss, but it is exactly what Trump said. And she reminds us about the time that Donald Trump was asked about how he felt about the Bible. And Sarah, I've just listened to this.
I'm wondering what one or two of your most favored Bible verses are and why.
I wouldn't want to get into it because to me that's very personal. You know, when I talk about the Bible, it's very personal. So I don't want to get into
There's no verse that means a lot to you that you think about or cite?
The Bible means a lot to me, but I don't want to get into specifics.
Even to cite a verse that
no,
you like?
No, I don't want to do that.
Testament guy or a New Testament guy?
Probably equal. I think it's just an incredible, the whole Bible is an incredible. I joke. Very much so. They always hold up the Art of the Deal. I say my second favorite book of all time. But I just think the Bible is just something very special.
He has no idea. None. Okay, so I can look at them and laugh. But if you're an evangelical pastor and this is really important to you, how do you not look at this guy and realize, you know, that he's treating it's a joke. He has no idea what's in the Bible. And he's just so cynically manipulating them, and yet they go along with it.
Yeah, and you know, it's there's actually sort of a subtle distinction there, but it's one thing for him when pressed to obviously lie about his intimate knowledge of the Bible, of which he clearly has none. It's another thing for him in this moment, you know, that church where he went was set on fire, much to the horror. It's about two blocks from our office, but much to the horror of many in the country, but especially people in Washington who know that church. It's right by the White House. Lots of presidents have gone there, so it's a hallowed space. But there's a difference between what Sarah Cooper is sort of mocking and the idea that he would go there and just hold up the Bible for a photo, and it's just the stunt of it, the using of it, and you know, he was asked at the time, is that your Bible? And he like responded, it's a Bible, which congratulations to him for being able to recognize it. But he held it up like it was a sign for Trump steaks, you know, just some other thing that he was selling. And I think for people who are Bible believing, that it is the inerrant word of God, that, you know, everybody who gets mad at the media and but liberals, whatever, if you can't look at that moment and think that it's not the most toxic, disgusting, that he's just making a mockery of the things that you believe in, the principles that you hold most dear, I don't know how. I don't know. I can't reconcile that.
Yeah. Cyrus, King David. It's like dumbed down Trumpism, as if there is such a thing as dumbed down Trumpism. Okay, I want to ask you about the polls, because in my newsletter this morning I cited a couple of brutal polls, but then a couple of others came out later. You have the Morning Consult poll showing Biden leading Trump nationally by 12 points, 51-39. Biden's leading among men by 6 points, women by 16 points. Biden leads among independents by 9 points, 43-34. He's getting 92% of Democrats. This poll has Trump getting only 84% of Republicans. And then there's the Reuters poll showing 55% of Americans are disapproving of Trump's handling of the protests. His overall job approval rating in this Reuters poll down to 39%. And this Reuters Ipsos poll is also finding that Biden's lead over Trump among registered voters is at 10%. Within a little while, though, another CNBC poll came out. I'm sure you've seen all this, but I don't have it right in front of me, showing, though, that Trump is still incredibly competitive in the swing seats in the swing states that will determine the Electoral College. So give me your sense of where we're at here, because you have some set of polls showing, you know, really a cratering of Trump's support, but you still have that Electoral College math.
There's a lot going on. I mean, obviously, national polls are something that everybody should be incredibly, not skeptical of the numbers, but just understanding that they don't matter. That like a 10-point margin in national polls, well, great. He's probably at, you know, what's his margin in California? Like, that's not important. And so it really does matter what his margin is in these swing states. And those are, Joe Biden is still leading in most of those swing states, with the exception of Wisconsin. But, you know, Florida's in play and pretty even. Trump is down pretty seriously in places like Arizona and Michigan. I think Biden's running about 5 points ahead in Pennsylvania. And all of that is very good for Joe Biden. But this election is going to look different than other elections. You know, we've been sort of lurching from crisis to crisis, but the coronavirus, which, you know, has just been like, is sort of magically wiped from the news because of the protests, is still with us and will likely be with us in the fall. It could have a resurgence after all of these people are grouped together in these, you know, there's a lot of all the protesters, they are mostly wearing masks, but to the extent that we don't know whether this tips off, you know, another round of infections. You know, Fauci and some of the other health experts have talked a lot about it coming back in the fall. And so, you know, as there's this fight going on about mail-in ballots, what I think is going to happen, part of what's going to happen is it's difficult to know what impact any of like what the coronavirus might have on how people vote, whether or not everybody, you know, feels comfortable voting, whether or not they have enough people to work at polling stations, whether or not people can count the ballots, you know, that night. A lot of the states aren't set up to receive as many mail-in and absentee ballots as they're going to get. And so, you know, I think it's just difficult to both plot exactly how the election might go and then also how it's going to look to the American people. Because I would suspect that at the end of the night, we still won't know on election day, we're not going to know who won.
Really?
Okay. Well, if you think about how many more mail-in and absentee ballots there are going to be, and knowing that most states, you know, don't have the technology on hand to count them the way that the states that do all mail or all absentee, or not all absentee, but do all mail, are, it's going to take a long time to count those. And there's going to be a lot fewer people showing up directly at the polls. Now, that could change. Maybe we've got a vaccine. Maybe the virus is gone. We have defeated it in some way. But the chances are that's not the case, and that the election looks different.
Well, this would be consistent with the 2020 timeline of, you know, what could possibly go wrong. Let's have an election that's not decided on election night that may actually stretch on for days or weeks of anxiety and division. And let's just set that aside for a moment. You mentioned in passing something that I think people ought to be more aware of. There's a stream of anger and confusion out there on this issue of the protests and the coronavirus. Up until last week, everybody in the media and in the medical community was united in the need to maintain social distancing. And if there were protests or demonstrations or gatherings, they were either banned or they were discouraged, or they were somewhat ridiculed, right, as vectors of disease. And let's be honest about it, there aren't a lot of masks at these protests, but the level of tisk-tisking about it is dramatically reduced. And I did see a statement from some medical professionals sort of endorsing the protest, which did raise the question, wait, was the social distancing a matter of life or death and killing grandma, or was it not? And so there are people who've made massive sacrifices in order to social distance, who've, you know, lost their businesses, lost their jobs, been in quarantine, and suddenly seeing folks saying, okay, well, now forget about this. We meant social distancing unless it was really, really important for us in terms of these protests. And I do think that that may be an underappreciated division that's out there.
Yeah. I mean, I just think about the way that I've been thinking about this and the fact that I haven't really left the house too often, and that, you know, when stuff comes into the house from a grocery store, we're still wiping it down with Clorox wipes, yeah, and taking lots of precautions, and, you know, talking about our kids having to be homeschooled again come the fall. And that may all come to pass and be true, but it's actually sort of crazy to just see people so close together after so many months of everybody, you know, making sure to keep their distance from one another. You know, I know that there was some letter circulated endorsing the protests from some public health officials. I'm not sure that those were, you know, the health officials we ought to be listening to. I think a lot of the health officials are very concerned that whether you sympathize with the protesters, that even if you do and you understand why they're out there and why they want to be out there, that, like, we're still in the midst of a pandemic and nobody knows how this is going to go. Now, if there are these mass protests and there's not a spike afterwards, that's probably a good sign that we can lower our guard slightly. But if there's a massive spike, and I don't know if you saw this, but there was about I think 15 cases from West Point, when then, you know, the West Point cadets were brought to listen, you know, there was a little outbreak there. So it does seem like when people are gathering in mass, it's a problem. And so I watch them feeling both supportive of their ultimate goal, but also sort of horrified by just how close people are together.
So you're in DC right now, and your office is near where a lot of those protests have been. So what does it look like on the ground? Have you been there? Have you seen them?
Yeah, I just drove by. I went down this morning and just to look around. And we're right. We're right down by the White House, and, you know, it's so unnerving because everything is boarded up in almost a six-ish block radius. There was our doors, you know, the doors to the Bulwark headquarters were smashed. Yeah. All of the restaurants and, you know, ice cream parlors and coffee shops had their windows smashed in on the block.
The Bulwark office building's windows were smashed?
The door. Yeah.
Really?
And it was more, we were pretty sturdy door, but there was clearly a rock or a brick had been thrown at it, because it was like the glass panel was shattered. Ooh, okay. But now they're all boarded up. Everything's boarded up now. So somebody had sent me a picture of the door. But we're right across from one of those little parks that always have sort of a statue in the middle of them. Yep. They're everywhere in DC, and you know, it's been defaced and graffitied, and it's very sad. It's interesting though. When I was just down there, they've put up a fence basically blocking off Lafayette Park, which is right outside of the White House. And so it's basically forcing people back, much further from the White House than they've been. And so I guess Trump got some kind of wall.
So yeah, he finally got his wall. So random thought here. I mean, as I think we have documented and discussed in great detail all of the failures of the Trump administration, but how does Bill de Blasio still have his job? I mean, I think you can hold these ideas in your head at the same time that Donald Trump is a disaster, but also recognizing that there are other disasters out there. And Bill de Blasio not only has botched this pandemic, but even Andrew Cuomo was calling him out for his disgraceful handling of the riots. So you know, look, there's this is not simply a right-left divide in terms of completely screwing up 2020.
Yeah, well, Bill de Blasio is probably my second least favorite politician on the planet. And he is horrible in his own right. And I think that this is my deepest hope, Charlie. And I live in a perennial place of disappointment. But my deepest hope is that you know, Bill de Blasio is like a perfect example of somebody who just like virtue signals all day long and is not displays zero competence, just like Trump. Right. And in this moment, as we've watched the sort of disaster of these past 3 months, one of the things that I think becomes clear, especially watching the difference between some of the governors and the federal response to the coronavirus, is that competency is actually a thing that we should still care about. Hmm. The ability of a politician as somebody who is an administrator at a very high level and who has to, you know, make tough decisions and tough calls and coordinate responses to things when they go wrong, you know, and this was really what Trump had going for him for his first 3 years, and for a lot of then more local politicians, you're basically able to separate the wheat from the chaff. Who is a capable steward of their government? And who, you know, got in because people thought they had the right politics, but they're actually not a very competent administrator.
Yeah, and I do think the virtue signaling, and by the way, here in Wisconsin, where we are, you know, 45-45 tied between Biden and Trump, some of the local officials have not been covering themselves with glory. The city of Madison has just failed miserably in controlling some of the violence. Now, that's not going to change how Madison votes because they're overwhelmingly Democratic. But, you know, around the state in the redder areas, people are looking at, you know, this is the way progressives fail to deal with crime and burning. And so the story in Wisconsin is one of the things to watch nationally is the way that the very de Blasio like that's sort of unfair to her, but very, very, very progressive mayor of the city of Madison has basically just completely dropped the ball in dealing with the social disorder. Okay, so I want to talk about your story because this feels like a question that we've been asking for the last 4 years, but it's all come home to roost over the last several weeks. And I assume that's why you wrote the piece. You know, it's like watching all of the things that are happening right now, to go back to the people who supported putting Donald Trump in the Oval Office, who said, yeah, this is the guy that we want to give the nuclear codes. This is the person who ought to be the commander in chief. What did they think was going to happen? Talk to me about your piece.
Yeah, I mean, watching, I think, the reaction across a lot of the, especially the anti-Trumpers, but a lot of people who were seeing the protests and just the chaos, and they greet that obviously with horror and with disbelief, but I understand the horror, but I don't quite understand the disbelief. I mean, when you Donald Trump, I think, is, as JVL, our colleague, has put it, is an arsonist pretending to be a fireman.
Yep.
And so, you know, if the Republican Party seemed to have hired Donald Trump to burn it all down. And so I don't understand why everybody's so surprised now that everything's on fire. What did they think was going to happen? And this is what, you know, when Donald Trump had this real lucky streak, right, where the economy is doing real well. And if you're not paying that much attention to politics the way you and I do, it's perfectly simple or perfectly rational to think, I don't know, this guy seems to be doing okay. My life is better. The country seems fine. And Donald Trump bumped along with that for many years without, you know, a real crisis, a real thing he had to react to. And now he's got three in very quick succession, right? He has the coronavirus and a health crisis that causes an economic crisis. And now we have a racial crisis. And the racial crisis is coming right after an entire country has been locked down for months. It is deeply frustrated. Many people are unemployed. I mean, you know, when people don't have jobs, it's a lot easier for them to go out and protest every night. And so I think that these things are compounding on one another. And
they're very much on brand too, aren't they? I mean, that's the thing about it is that each of these crises, these failures, you can, you know, play the string back to realize that, well, this is what you get when you have somebody who lies all the time, somebody who has, you know, the complete lack of empathy, who doesn't care about the actual business of governing. So none of this is like a random failure for Donald Trump. I mean, that, and I think that's the point of your piece. All of this was latent from the very beginning, and it was all right there if you were willing to look at it.
This is a totally predictable crisis. And one of the ways that you could predict it, and I think the Never Trumpers did predict it, is that, you know, again, I know you remember this, but when I was coming up as a young conservative, I read a lot of Peggy Noonan. And, you know, when the Clinton era, one of the favorite, one of sort of the mantra of the conservative movement during the Clinton era was that character counted. Character really mattered. Because you can hire, you didn't have to be brilliant. You could hire brilliant people. You can hire strategists. But the one thing a president's got to come in with is a sense of decency, of duty, of a love for people, a wanting to help people. You have to have good character. And to, if you hire somebody who is bereft of character, I mean, that was the big about face that I think we couldn't understand that was coming from conservatives, is the idea that character no longer had any meaning or place or wasn't a thing that was an absolute requirement. It was, in fact, the thing that everybody just decided they could dismiss. Like, well, yeah, his character's bad, but, you know, we're going to have this policy or this, our tax cuts, our judges. But of course, an absence of character, these are these defining moments then, right? A crisis hits and the character of a president helps define the character of a country. And this guy has no character. And so, yeah, why is everybody shocked that that things are engulfed in chaos?
You know, you probably noticed I don't spend a lot of time talking about Joe Biden, because at least personally, I feel this is an election more about, you know, up or down on Donald Trump. But you have a very interesting piece in the, on the NBC website, the Think site, where you were comparing and contrasting the messages from Trump versus Biden on all of this. And you know, you have a line, President Donald Trump, the nominal heir to the party of Abraham Lincoln, Ulysses S. Grant, Dwight D. Eisenhower, and Ronald Reagan, made only passing reference in his speech Monday evening to the outrage at Floyd's death and legitimate peaceful protest before turning his attention to his favorite topic, violence. So the give me your sense of the book ending that we're getting here, because it, and again, I'm not a huge Biden fan, but the contrast in their approaches to this issue couldn't be more dramatic. And I mean, it really strikes me that the way that they are dealing with this is, you know, underlines the point you just made a couple of minutes ago.
Yeah. I mean, I think that I didn't never spend a lot of time thinking about Joe Biden. He was a Democrat. He, you know, always seemed fine, but you know, he has a lot, a bunch of things in his past that I remembered about, you know, plagiarizing things and, you know, and his sort of Uncle Joe shtick can really come off like a shtick. And so I hadn't thought about him that much, but there's obviously two things going on here. One is the bar has been so lowered on Joe Biden. I think Donald Trump has, and his team have made a strategic mistake by going all in on the idea that this guy is senile, that he's basically drooling on himself and like living in a nursing home. Because then when he comes out like he did yesterday and makes a totally competent and coherent speech in which he talks about the character of the country, in which he, you know, lays out a vision of an imperfect America that is always striving to be better, he clears that very low bar and he does it quite handily. And so he you know, when your expectations are so, he looks almost like a great orator. And I
think that's true. I really think that's true.
And then also, I just think, you know, Donald Trump gave a speech the night before there in the Rose Garden, right before they pepperballed all those peaceful protesters so he could go have his photo op at the church. He gave this, you know, this speech that it really is, they always sort of make me sick to my stomach because his indecency is always on full display. Speeches are always poorly written, like just as a craft, they're never good. And also, you know, he sort of leans into this, there's one law, which of course isn't true, and law and order, and he just says these things over and over again in these weird repetitious style, and he talks about how he's going to dominate people. And then Joe Biden gives a speech where he talks about how we're always trying to be better and we're trying, America's an imperfect place, but it's a great place. And like, he sounds to me like Joe Biden in that speech, one, what's not about policy. It's just about, it's about who we are as a country. He sounds like he could be like a George H.W. Bush, you know, like it sounds like one of these thousand points of light. Hey, we're imperfect, but we're trying to be better. And we fight every day. And I want to live in Joe Biden's vision of America. I don't want to live in Donald Trump's vision of America.
Well, I think also the point that you made, though, is that you have very dramatically contrasting views of what constitutes patriotism. You know, yeah. I consider myself a patriot. And, you know, before Trump, I think one of the things that conservatives did was they made it okay to be a patriot again. And I am a patriot. And the Donald Trump era sort of it has tested that. It actually has made me more patriotic because I want to protect my country. And now you're having a debate, I think, between two visions of what it means. You know, Donald Trump, you know, the America first, this raw sort of dominating image versus another kind of patriotism, which I'm completely comfortable with, where Joe Biden seems to be the guy that understands patriotism as a recognition of American exceptionalism. But his version of what makes America special is completely different than what Donald Trump thinks makes America special.
Yeah, I mean, I've always thought that just like with the Bible photo op, that the Trump's cartoonish version of patriotism, you know, it's all performative. And right. And it also it's also always seemed a little bit of a perversion of patriotism into something more sinister that is like a kind of nationalism. That is a different kind of thing than I think, because the patriotism, I think you can really be a patriot and look at what, and it's funny to go back and revisit the Colin Kaepernick sort of culture war, because I would say that I was kind of like, I don't know. I wish people didn't kneel for the national anthem and whatever. And now I look back at that, and I will take that version of patriotism, the peaceful protest to say, here's a thing I object to that's happening and I want to call attention to it. I will take that every day and twice on Sunday over this populist nationalism thing that Trump is trying to sell us.
I'm glad you raised that, because, you know, in the Olympics of hypocrisy that continues to be ongoing, it was interesting when Mike Pence the other day tweeted out something about, you know, yes, of course, you know, we honor peaceful protests, but not violent protests, which, of course, is anodyne, except that he was the guy that actually staged that, well, another stunt where he storms out of an NFL game because some of the players exercised their First Amendment right to peacefully protest. And Tim Miller found that section from Cliff Sims' rather overrated book about Donald Trump, where Trump is like salivating over the prospect of running against a kneeler, that kneeling was the worst thing that you could do. So here's one of those moments. Do you want peaceful protest or not? Because that does look a lot different in retrospect, doesn't it?
It does, and I've found it actually quite powerful that one of the ways that the police officers in the places where the protests are going well, and the police officers take a knee with the protesters just to show them like, hey, we're here for you guys. I find that tremendously moving. Certainly in contrast to the pictures of the police in riot gear pushing back on protesters. And look, when people should not throw people that are throwing things at cops and doing all that stuff like that is awful. And they definitely should not do that. But there is something that is so destructive to the American psyche when you watch people who have a point they want to make and police and riot gear face off against each other, because it feels in that civil warishness, that idea that we're broken, we're facing off against ourselves, that feels terrible. And to have this sort of, when the cops sort of take a knee and like you have that moment where you see like, oh yeah, everybody's an American here. We hear what you're saying. I am. Those have been the best thing I've seen on the internet lately.
No, and the flip side, of course, though, are that dystopian picture from the steps of the Lincoln Memorial. Did you see that? Where you have these look like stormtroopers. It's a bizarre scene. I have to tell you, one of the most haunting things that I've read in the last 24 hours, though, was from JVL's newsletter yesterday. How we got to Kent State. Now I remember Kent State very well. I remember 1970, but I'd forgotten this little detail. And JVL talks about this in his newsletter, and it's on the website right now. The governor of Ohio back then was named Jim Rhodes, and he gave a speech to the state on Sunday, May 3rd, and he's talking about the protests at Kent State, and he said this is probably the most vicious form of campus-oriented violence yet perpetrated by dissident groups or their allies. And he goes on, talked about that we are going to use every weapon of the law enforcement agencies of Ohio to drive them out of Kent. They are worse than the brown shirts and the communist element and also the night riders and the vigilantes. They are, referring to the protesters, they are the worst type of people that we harbor in America. It's over with in Ohio. I think we are up against the strongest, well-trained, militant, revolutionary group that has ever assembled in America. We are going to eradicate the problem, okay? And as JVL notes, the governor's speech was not just broadcast, you know, to the public. It was piped into the National Guard's bivouac on the campus of Kent State University, and that was May 3rd. The next day, May 4th, 1970, that group of National Guardsmen fired indiscriminately into a group of unarmed students on the campus at the moment when the students presented no immediate threat, and they killed four students and wounded nine others. So, you know, the haunting thing is this kind of escalating rhetoric can lead to really horrific outcomes. We're not there yet, but we are. I mean, you don't have to reach far to get kind of the parallel of the kind of the demonization and the rhetoric that we're getting piped out there. And I'm watching some of these cops, and I've seen the same videos you're talking about, but I've also seen cops that I wonder what voices are in their heads, because the way they're responding to the protesters is more than a little disturbing. But that's a scary story. I mean, that Kent State story is terrifying.
It is. And let me just want to go back to one very quick thing, because you mentioned the polling, and I wanted to bring up, you know, I do these focus groups in an ongoing way with, you know, sort of reluctant Trump voters, Republicans who voted for Trump, kind of holding their nose to understand what moves them. And one of the things that I've heard all along, especially from women, about one of the things they don't like about Trump the most is that they feel like he's erratic, that they don't trust his judgment. And that to me was always something that seemed like would be persuasive to people if it came to a moment where his judgment really mattered for something in a major way. And so I think about those women all the time in these moments where everything is erratic and his judgment is failing him and the country left and right. And just to think about it from an electoral standpoint, you know, there's a lot of people who I think would argue that this might be good for Donald Trump in some way because he gets to order the military around and, you know, there's pictures of looters and things like that. I think that there are a lot of people who do not want Donald Trump in charge of chaos. And so I think
that's right.
Not good for him.
No, I agree. And I wonder whether the statement from Mike Esper this morning, the Secretary of Defense, would also reflect the fact that there are people within the military in the military community who are pushing back. We have a very, very diverse military, and not everybody wants to, you know, don the riot gear and do this sort of thing. I mean, let me just read you his statement, which is, you know, very much at variance with what Trump is pushing. The option to use active duty forces in a law enforcement role should only be used as a matter of last resort and only in the most urgent and dire of situations. We are not in one of those situations now. I do not support invoking the Insurrection Act. Whoa. Okay, so there's a little pushback there, Sarah.
It's about time. I mean, this is what President Trump is doing with the Insurrection Act is flagrantly absurd. And so, you know, obviously he's got the full backing of people like Bill Barr, but there are people who are looking, who know that 6 months from now, Donald Trump may be tossed out of office. And that I would not be at all surprised if you started to see a little more CYA from people, because what he is doing is outrageous and people should be outraged by it. In fact, I am, even though it's impressive by the measure of the fact that so many, nobody's willing to do it. That is a low bar. So many people right now should be telling the president, this is wrong.
No, you're exactly right. And the only way to end the American carnage is on election day. There's a very, very powerful new ad. You may have seen it. It's really awesome. I mean, it is awesome.
Thanks, Charlie. Yeah, if people should check it out. Republican Voters Against Trump is a new group we've launched.
And it is
last night.
You know what's actually really cool, you know, sitting sort of on the sidelines here, is watching the Lincoln Project and the Republican Voters Against Trump, and sort of you're not rivals with one another, but it is this sort of like, you know, we can be significant players here, because I think those are the strongest things on the air right now.
Yeah,
and it's remarkable.
Yeah, we're all buddies. We all know each other. But I do think there's a lot of remarking about that sort of on the internet about the Republicans making, you know, some of the hardest hitting ads against Trump. But I think one of the things that Democrats may not quite understand, or maybe they do, certainly if they listen to this podcast, they do, that there's probably no group of people that feels stronger about getting rid of Donald Trump than the Republicans, who feel like he hijacked their party, hijacked their country, you know, ruined their relationships, unmoored them from lots of the things they thought they believed. Like, we are coming for him in a way that might be different than your run-of-the-mill Democrat.
Sarah Longwell, great to have you back on the podcast. Appreciate it very much.
Thanks, Charlie.
And thank you for listening to today's Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We'll be back tomorrow, and we will do this all over again.